Chapter 21. The Impact of the Gadget on Civilization. My feeling about Oppenheimer was, at that time, that this was a man who was angelic, true, and honest, and he could do no wrong. I believed in him. Robert Wilson. Everyone sensed Oppie's presence. He drove himself around the hill in an army jeep or in his own large black Buick, dropping in unannounced on one of the laboratory's scattered offices. Usually he'd sit in the back of the room, chain-smoking and listening quietly to the discussion. His mere presence seemed to galvanize people to greater efforts.
Vicky Weisskopf marveled at how often Oppie seemed to be physically present at each new breakthrough in the project.
He was present in the laboratory or in the seminar room when a new effect was measured, when a new idea was conceived. It was not that he contributed so many ideas or suggestions. He did so sometimes, but his main influence came from his continuous and intense presence, which produced a sense of direct participation in all of us. Hans Bethe recalled the day Oppie dropped into a session on metallurgy and listened to an inconclusive debate over what type of refractory container should be used for melting plutonium. After listening to the argument, Oppie summed up the discussion. He didn't directly propose a solution, but by the time he left the room, the right answer was clear to all. By contrast, General Groh's visits were always interruptions, and sometimes comically disruptive. One day, Oppie was showing Groves around a lab when the general put his considerable weight on one of three rubber tubes funneling hot water into a casing.
As McAllister Hull recalled for the historian Charles Thorpe,
it, the rubber tube, pops off the wall and a stream of water just below the boiling point shoots across the room. And if you've ever seen a picture of Groves, you know what it hit. Oppenheimer looked over his soaking wet general and quipped, "Well, just goes to show the incompressibility of water." Oppie's interventions sometimes proved to be absolutely essential to the success of the project. He understood that the single major impediment to building a usable weapon quickly was the meager supply of fissionable material, and so he was constantly looking for ways to accelerate the production of these materials. Early in 1943, Groves and his S1 executive committee had settled on gaseous diffusion and electromagnetic technologies to separate out enriched fissionable uranium for the Los Alamos bomb lab. At the time, another possible technology, based on liquid thermal diffusion, had been rejected as unfeasible. But in the spring of 1944, Oppenheimer read some year-old reports about liquid thermal diffusion and decided that this had been a mistake. He thought this technology represented a relatively cheap path to providing partially enriched uranium for the electromagnetic process. So in April 1944, he wrote Groves that a liquid thermal diffusion plant might serve as a stopgap measure. Its production of even slightly enriched uranium could then be fed to the electromagnetic diffusion plant and thereby accelerate production of fissionable material. It was his hope, he wrote, that the production of the Y-12 electromagnetic plant could be increased by some 30% to 40%, and its enhancement somewhat improved many months earlier than the scheduled date for K-25, gaseous diffusion production. After sitting on Oppie's recommendation for a month, Groves agreed to explore it. A plant was rushed into production, and by the spring of 1945, it was producing just enough extra partially enriched uranium to guarantee a sufficient amount of fissionable material for one bomb by the end of July 1945. Oppenheimer had always possessed a high degree of confidence in the uranium gun design program, whereby a slug of fissionable material would be fired into a target of additional fissionable matter, creating criticality and a nuclear explosion. But in the spring of 1944, he suddenly faced a crisis that threatened to derail the entire effort to design a plutonium bomb. While Oppenheimer had authorized Seth Neddermeyer to conduct explosive experiments aimed at creating an implosion design bomb, a loosely packed sphere of fissionable material that could be instantly compressed to reach criticality, he had always hoped that a straightforward gun assembly would prove viable for the plutonium bomb. In July 1944, however, it became clear from tests performed on the first small supplies of plutonium that an efficient plutonium bomb could not be triggered within the gun barrel design. Indeed, any such attempt would undoubtedly lead to a catastrophic pre-detonation inside the plutonium gun. One solution might have been to separate further the plutonium materials in an attempt to make a more stable element. One could have separated out those bad plutonium isotopes from the good ones, John Manley explained. But that would have meant duplicating everything that had been done for uranium isotope separation, all those big plants, and there was just no time to do that. The choice was to junk the whole discovery of the chain reaction that produced plutonium and all of the investment in time and effort of the Hanford plant, unless somebody could come up with a way of assembling the plutonium material into a weapon that would explode.